you just, for most things, you just dial up what you want, key it, you wait up to 15 seconds for the tone, the tone goes away, you're tuned. The older airplanes, and I'm talking quite a bit older, used the Sun Air HF, which had a motor mounted in the tail with a little drum with wire on it. There was a weight on the end of the wire, and they would run the wire out until they got a resonance indication on the panel, and then they were good to go.
Thank you, Tom. Good information. By the way, Tom, each time we turn it back to you, you pick up the mic immediately. You don't wait for the beeps. And you were lucky you didn't time out each time we did that. Thank you. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, have you noticed that you've lost Channel 2 on over-the-air TV? Have they moved the antenna or changed frequency or something like that? I have a couple of different boxes, and they're gone for like the last 4 days that I know of. I didn't try scanning for new stations. Maybe I'll have to do that, but back to you, Dick.
In the beginning of April, Channel 4 over the air changed their frequencies, and you had to do some rescanning. I don't think Channel 2 has done that over the air, and I was watching 60 Minutes tonight, Channel 2, just before this program began, before we began on TechNet. So from my point of view, Channel 2 is on the air. Pass it back to you, Paul. Drag your feet in case Eric wants to say any words on this. WS2N with a delay, K2IW in the TechNet.
I missed that. You want to tell me?
Yeah, from his point of view, Channel 2 has gone off the air in the last couple of days. From my point of view, it has not. Channel 2 over the air is still there. In the beginning of April, Channel 4 changed its frequencies and you had to do some rescanning. But I don't think Channel 2 over the air has made any changes. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, let's see. It was Thursday night or Friday night. I forget. There was some work being done, and they went to, they got interrupted for a short period of time. It was just a short period of time. Give me a second. Let me see what the signal strength looks like now, and I'll tell you.
Okay, while Eric is doing that checking, what time of day were you not seeing Channel 2, Paul, WS2N?
Oh, I tried it in the morning, and I probably tried it at 5, 6 o'clock. And I have a couple of boxes. I've got three different boxes. And, you know, I thought maybe it was the one box, but all three are doing exactly what you said. And by the way, yeah, I'm aware of the Channel 4 change. Yeah, that worked out okay. That was a couple of weeks ago, I think. Two was giving me a problem. Maybe Eric knows. Back to you then.
I see what Eric has found out. By the way, Eric, when you do come back, I am guessing that Roy, AC2GS in southern Brooklyn, is using a different voting input than I am, and he does get periodic half-second dropouts, which he thought was over-modulation of his audio. I don't think so. I think there's something peculiar about the RF link between him and his particular voting input. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. Channel 2 is Channel 33, actually. Yeah, it looks normal. Even the symbols look normal, so. I don't think they've changed anything. And as far as Roy goes, I started watching when you mentioned it, and I didn't see anything.
WH2ORY with a comment. RF22, which is also WCBS, has been going on and off the air for the past week or two. That probably answers Paul's question. And it's not on the air right now.
Did you say Channel 22?
RF Channel 22, coming out of Ridge. Same place as WLNY.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, because they originally going to put 22 here. I can't tell you about 22, although I could swing the antenna around and look it the other way, but I take your word for it.
Now, because Paul in Ronkonkoma, he probably can get the Ridge or Riverhead, whichever it is, 22, easier than New York City 33, and therefore that's the channel 22, that's the channel number 2 advertised that he has been watching, and therefore that sort of explains it. Over to you, Eric, KE2.
Likewise. With the RF change of locations, or antenna changes, Dick, Paul, you might want to do a rescan, and you'll probably pick up the better signal strength of RF-33 coming off the Trade Center. Maybe you didn't have that previously in your converter. You're primarily relying on RF-22, because it's both going to come out to be channel 2-1 and 2-2.
It's still on Empire.
You've got it, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I got 3 different boxes, so I'll have to redo all of them. And some of them, they drive you crazy. You gain one, but then you lose another one, you know. Sometimes you just can't add to it. Some of them you can. Very good, thanks, Joe. That makes sense if you, yeah, it's been like the last 4 days, or like you said, a week. Understood. I'll go play with the boxes tomorrow. Back to you, Dick.
One of the ways you can get some further information on this, Paul, is does your system allow you to know what RF frequency is listening to when it's listening to advertised channel number 2? WS2N, K2IW, wait for the beeps.
I never know unless I look up the information on the internet. No, the boxes don't tell me. So anytime you guys talk about that, I get lost. I just know what the actual number is. Back to you, Dick.
I'd like to believe that the menus built into your box, if you dig deep enough, allow you to know what RF frequency you're on. In the case of my Vizio set, I haven't found a way of knowing what RF frequency it's on. So maybe some of the modern day sets make that difficult. Let's see if Eric's got any opinion on this one. KE2EJ, K2IW.
It's really up to the manufacturer and what they want to put in their software. Like, I've got an LG set here, and it tells you what RF channel it is.
Yes, my old Radio Shack converter would also tell me. And I could dial the RF frequency I wanted it to go to. The modern day sets have made it so automated, they don't tell you, and they give you very little control. You can rescan the whole damn band, but if between channel 2 and 4, you wanted to have it only scan that region and look for new stations, some of these systems won't allow you to do that. Now, back to another one of our questions, Eric, and that is Roy AC2GS. For the last few weeks, he gets, once every 30 seconds, he gets a dropout of half a second as he's talking. And is it because of voice peaks being too high? I doubt it. There are times when it happens when there's a pause in his speech. And I don't get it. So the particular voting input that he's using in Brooklyn, is there something unique about it that gives him a periodic dropout of half a second while he's talking, roughly once every 30 seconds or so it occurs? KE2EJ, K2IW, the tech man.
All right, well, first of all, he's using the Glen Oaks receiver. Okay. And I actually get a graph of the signal strength coming in. And I'm going to watch it, and let me see if I can experience that happening, because after you mentioned it, I didn't see a thing, so. Roy's just about up, and when I see something, I'll let you know.
Okay. And I've listened on the input, and I don't think it's on Roy's signal itself. For some reason, we do get a dropout on the 8.5 output. So, Roy, you've got a great big long pile of a list of subjects that you can discuss. It's so difficult for you to choose the right one. AC2GS, our science and physics expert, K2IW. Go right ahead, Roy. And by the way, the drone in the box that you mentioned to me in the last internet is a pretty good one. It's a modification of the birds in the truck, but there's a lot of information there. AC2GS, K2IW. You got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. Once again, for anyone interested, if you have any topics or questions that you want covered or discussed, the email address is mailbag ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I thought I would start the night with a little bedtime story called Polly Water, a time that science got it wrong. Science is a process, and the scientific method is its foundation. If you ask the internet for a definition of the scientific method, you'll get something like, quote, a method of procedure that has characterized natural science since the 17th century, consisting in systematic observation, measurement, and experiment, and the formulation, testing, and modification of hypotheses, end quote. Sometimes science falls down a rabbit hole, but the beauty of the scientific method is that given enough time, it writes itself eventually. Polly Water is a tale of when science tripped but averted itself from a pratfall. Let me drop.
Dick, I have a comment for you. I'm monitoring his transmission. He is going off the air on NCMC. That's what receiver he is keying beside Glen Oaks. And I do hear that one doing exactly what you're talking about. So it's something with his transmitter.
I don't know if I agree with that, because his RF output is constant. But then again, I'm not sampling it often enough to be able to tell.
Well, I am very confident because I'm listening to both frequencies. He does not hit Plainview. He hits NCMC only, and as well as Glen Oaks. And and NCMC is going off the air occasionally, like for a split second. And it coincides with his signal on 8.5.
Yeah, I just turned the hospital receiver off because I see it switching between Glen Oaks and the hospital. But the RF going into Glen Oaks is, if I can increase the sample rate of this, I can tell better, but it looks like it's constant.
Well, I'm listening to the transmit output from NCMC. I sent Dick an email on this, so he knows what I'm talking about. That transmitter is going off for a split second. If you're not listening to that, then you're not listening to the same thing I'm listening to.
And by the way, there were two interruptions on that last transmission. And I can tell that I'm now going into the same voting system because I'm a little bit noisier. So during Roy's last transmission, two very brief dropouts did occur on 8.5. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Saw that, Dick. What happened was it switched over to the hospital for a moment and then switched back. And by the way, you are going into Glen Oaks, which is the main receiver that he's going into.
Okay, but I'm a little bit noisier now. Is that because I'm less noisy when I'm into, when I go to NCMC, I'm less noisy. And I think I've got my antenna aimed the wrong way. I've got to change the aiming. Over to you, Eric.
All right, hang on. Let me turn off Glen Oaks. And I'll turn off Plainview.
Now I'm a lot quieter. Over to you, Eric. So, what was making me noisy?
You're still noisy.
Okay. What's coming out of 8.5 right now is not noisy. Two transmissions of mine ago, I was noisy. What was happening there? What had changed, Eric?
Okay, I gotta keep turning this on because I'm running really low power here. I turned off all receivers except for the hospital. You're not noisy in there. Now I'm gonna turn on Glen Oaks and turn the other receivers off, and you'll find yourself being somewhat noisy.
Yes. And I'm now changing the aiming of the antenna. Uh-huh. There's the problem. My antenna was aimed too far south. I do remember looking at it. I've got to rechange the orientation of my antenna rotator. Okay, I think we've pinned down a little bit of it. So, Roy, please proceed. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. This particular tale begins in 1961 in the old Soviet Union. This discovery was not their first scientific misstep, and it was not their last one either. It all began with a Soviet scientist by the name of Nikolai Fedyaykin while working at the Technical Institute of Kostroma, Russia. He was performing a series of experiments on common water, which he had condensed in and forced through a series of narrow quartz capillary tubes. He measured a change in many properties of this water. It seemed to possess a higher boiling point, a lower freezing point, and a much higher viscosity than the common water that he first started with at the beginning of his experiment. Another Soviet scientist, Boris Derzhagin, the director of a laboratory for surface physics at the Institute for Physical Chemistry in Moscow, heard about Fedyaykin's findings and decided to investigate these. He succeeded in improving Fedyaykin's technique, although his method would also produce very small quantities of this odd water. He produced much less time. Let me drop.
Okay.
He then went on to carefully measure how his samples were different than regular water. He found that his new water sample seemed to possess a freezing point of minus 40 degrees centigrade and a boiling point of 150 degrees centigrade, as well as a density of 1.1 to 1 gram per cubic centimeter. His results were published in the Soviet Union and were even translated into English and published in an article in Chemical Abstracts, but these seem not to excite any interest outside of the Soviet Union. Let me drop.
Go ahead, Eric. I made one brief transmission which could have created confusion, but beyond that, there was one dropout on Eric's signal. Go ahead, Eric.
I'm seeing a little dip. That could be an appearance of some kind as opposed to his transmitter dropping out. The signal strength is pretty strong. It's not weak. As far as, I mean, I think I have the filter set in that receiver in there, well, like it should be. But I'm not correlating the dropout with the stimulus of the speech, but then again, I can't hear it.
Yeah, all of my experience is not correlated with his speech. So, an extraneous interference that only gives you a momentary glitch, and it does sound like the voting system is making a switch during each one of his dropouts that occur at roughly once per 30 seconds. Over to you, Eric, for any further comment. KE2EJ, KGIW.
Yeah, when I hear the clicks, I see the voters just drop out, and actually they all drop out. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to put him on the hospital, which is going to make him a little bit noisy, but let's see if we get the same result.
Okay. AC2GS, go right ahead. KGIW in the group.
Okay. In 1966, Derzhagin visited England as part of a series of presentations for the discussion of the Faraday Society in Nottingham, England. He presented his work there, calling his discovery anomalous water. Soon, English scientists started investigating this water, and by 1968, there were even some scientific curiosity in the United States. In 1969, the popular press got really interested in it, and there were articles decrying the U.S. military was concerned that we might be suffering from a polywater gas with the Soviet Union, as the anomalous water had been renamed. It was very popular to worry about all sorts of gaps with the USSR in those days, the missile gap, the cruiser gap. The Apollo space program was designed to deal with our space gap. Let me drop. During those early days, there was a lot of conjecture, a lot. But this curious poly water escaped the lab and contaminated our water tables and ourselves. What would happen if all our water turned into this poly water? And what the heck was poly water anyway? The theory was that it was an unknown form of polymerized water molecules strung together. Many scientists had a lot of problems with Jogan's findings. But the popular press really loved this stuff. And I still remember a do-it-yourself article in an issue of Popular Science, Make Your Own Poly Water. And then everything went pear-shaped. Although papers on creating the substance urged meticulous methods so as not to introduce contaminants, that is easier in theory than in practice. Dennis Rousseau and Sergio Porto over at the good old Bell Labs pointed an infrared thermometer at a sample and found mostly chlorine and sodium ions. Let me drop. Chemical analysis of this exciting new form of water showed contaminants, which explained melting and freezing point. Examination of the poly water under an electron microscope showed small solids contaminating it, explaining the increased viscosity reported. When scientists repeated the experiment, extremely fastidious technique that did away with the previous contaminations, the poly water seemed to act just like regular water. Clean your glassware, guys. Failure is a tough thing. In the Soviet Union, it took a few more years for them to come to the conclusion that there was no such thing as poly water. Finally, in 1973, Jurjagan published a letter in the prestigious journal Nature stating, quote, these anomalous properties should be attributed to impurities rather than to the existence of polymeric molecules, end quote. Even the great physicist had an epitaph for the possibility of poly water ever existing. Let me drop.
Two giants.
Yeah, I've seen a total of 3 dropouts. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. This is a completely different receiver. The voter is not voting, and you're getting the same result. Now, from what I'm seeing here, I'm going to take a guess as to what the problem is. Okay, his signal strength is actually stronger than yours, Dick. It's not a signal strength issue. I think, and I can't tell you right now because I'm not set up for it, I think this PL is too low.
How about that? Do you have a way of adjusting your PL amplitude, Roy?
Unfortunately not. I'm working on my Flex 6700, which I'm still amazed it's actually working for repeaters. I mean, it doesn't even do a knock the PL tone that's being transmitted. So, no, I have no way to adjust the PL level. I can adjust the frequency, but not the level of the tone.
Now, you're saying, Eric, that his signal is stronger than mine. I'm hearing a little bit of a hiss on his signal, and right now I'm hearing no hiss on my signal. So if I was only going by the sound of what's coming out of A5, I would have the mistaken impression that my signal is stronger than his. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Right now, look, that's because right now we're using just a hospital receiver. When I'm looking at signal strength, I'm looking at what's coming out of Glen Oaks. Okay, if I go back to Glen Oaks, which I'm going to do now, and not let the hospital, now when you make the comparison, what I just said will be correct.
Okay. Yeah, my signal has got a little bit of noise on it. Let's see how your signal is doing, Roy. AC2GS, go ahead.
Okay, this is me here in Brooklyn. This is my signal. Hopefully it's a good signal. It's not a noisy signal. And hopefully it has less drops than it did, but who knows.
Nice and clean. By the way, since your signal is good and strong, do you have any other 2-meter transmitter that doesn't put as quite as many watts, but maybe it's got a little stronger PL tone that you could be using at some later time if you wanted to? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yeah, I have another one. I mean, unfortunately, I'm down to my last antenna, so I'd have to rewire things for it to operate. And I really enjoy using my Plex 6700, and I don't get these dropouts when I play around with my local KC2RC repeater in the neighborhood. So I don't know why I'm having such a problem with Limark's repeater.
Yeah, each repeater is different as to what the minimum amplitude of the PL tone has to be. So, Eric's guess at PL tone could be a factor. But the dropout is only a fraction of a second. We don't miss a word. It's only a minor detail. Don't worry. So, it looks like poly water was all contamination in the beginning. But the amount of contamination that'll make the boiling point go from 100 degrees centigrade to 150, I think you said. Boy, that takes a lot of contamination from my point of view. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Can I make a suggestion that Roy back away from his mic a little bit? Maybe the audio will be a little lower, but we can find out if it does the same thing.
He did that earlier. He started off at the beginning of the net with much lower audio, and the dropouts were the same. So right now, the PL tone guess sounds like a good one, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
All our gear throughout all the receivers, they're all the same. They're all master 3.
And the way they decode PL is by using a DSP, so the ability to code from receiver to receiver is going to be exactly the same.
Yeah, in the beginning of this transmission, in the beginning of the net, he was using lower audio, and he was still getting a dropout. On top of that, a fair number of the dropouts are during a pause in his speech, so I don't think it's a deviation problem. Okay, so how in the world do you get 150 degrees centigrade out of water boiling temperature? That takes a lot of contamination from my point of view. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Okay, we'll get right back to that. Let me just finish my little spiel. It goes to the end. The reason that since poly water was believed to have a higher boiling point than normal water, according to the laws of thermodynamics, that meant that it was more stable than normal water. And so on contact, any normal water would turn into poly water. Even Professor Richard Feynman had some paradoxes. If poly water truly existed, that life could simply live on the energy released by ingesting normal water and excreting poly. And so poly water was reassigned to the subject of pathological science, along with N-rays and the Martian canals, or the miracle thermal insulating plastic invented more than 30 years ago called Star by its British retired hairdresser inventor Maurice, said to survive the force of 75 Hiroshima explosions. Well, at least that's what Maurice told the press. But those are tales for another day. So that's my little spiel. And as far as the poly water, the point was that there was so little of this stuff measurable that the amount of contaminants were probably 50% of the measured sample.
So are you saying that when they tried to separate poly water from regular water, they only got a couple of drops of it, so to speak? Is that what you're saying, Roy?
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand that what they were really doing was drawing water back and forth into a whole bunch of not terribly clean capillary tubes. And what you inevitably got was a very, very small amount of the water and a large amount of the contaminants that were in all the capillary tubes. So, I mean, they were working with one or two drops of fluid. And so the stuff was completely contaminated by everything you can think of that would be in a capillary tube.
What sometimes happens with these phony science situations is that at first, other laboratories want to make sure they're not left out. They try duplicating the experiment, and for a short period of time, they also get a confirmation. Was there more than one laboratory that got at least a small period of time a confirmation of poly water existence? Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, there were at least two. There was the first guy who came up with it when he was doing his fiddling little experiments, and there was another guy who read his report and his lab and did the same bad technique. As long as you have awful lab technique, if you keep running water through capillary tubes, eventually you'll get enough contaminants to get very interesting findings. So the guys who weren't terribly fastidious could repeat these results plus or minus a degree of a melting point or boiling point or what have you. But it just took sloppy laboratory work to repeat it, unfortunately.
WS-1.
Go ahead, Paul.
Roy, why was the Russians excited about this? What were they planning to do with it? You know, what benefit did they think they were going to get by having this, even so it turned out to be fake or bad results? Suppose it was good. What would the benefit have been? You know, is it going to be some kind of new water that they're going to add to the food to make it taste better? Or, you know, a better oxidizer? Or what were they going to do with this stuff?
No, as far as I'm aware, it was just pure chemistry and pure science. These guys didn't really think of in the long term of what it would do. It was just a great discovery for Mother Russia. And they just kind of loved this sort of stuff. So it was new. And, I mean, think of it. We don't think of polymerizing water. We don't think about it because it doesn't happen. But these guys put two and two together, came up with 316 and a half, and decided that this was polymerized water. And so it was going to be a whole new branch of chemistry. So, and, you know, they would name these things after, and, you know, maybe they'll get a Nobel Prize out of it.
And who was the group that figured out that this was no good? Was it the Americans, or did the Russians finally say that this is no good?
No, it took the Russians until 1973. It was our boys at Bell Labs who thought of running an IR spectrometer through it to see what the heck was going on in there. Because you could do that with a drop or two of liquid. You don't really need much. Or I'm surprised they didn't put it through a mass spec.
So the IR spectrometer done by, I think you said Bell Labs, did they ask for a sample of the poly water from the Russians and then ran the IR spectrometer on it? Over to you, Roy.
Not sure if they got a sample specifically from the Russians. You have to understand, back then, like I mentioned, there was a popular science magazine article that I remember reading as a kid where it told people how to make their own poly water. And it was basically just grab a lot of capillary tubes and just keep drawing the fluid back in through it and in through it and in through it, and eventually you'll get some. So I guess the guys at Bell Labs simply repeated the popular science cookbook direction.
Give us a couple of words on this capillary tubes. A capillary tube, if I understand it, is a very small diameter piece of tubing, and by the surface tension effect, the water will crawl up that tube. So you you use the tube to let the water crawl up, and then you dump it out. Is that approximately what goes on? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what these rascally guys in the Soviet Union decided to do one day, that they just kept on running it through different capillary tubes. I mean, when I was a chemistry major, we used to use capillary tubes, and you could do interesting things with them. You could find the boiling point of microscopic amounts of liquid and do all kind of fun stuff. But I don't think we ever just kept drawing stuff through multiple samples of capillary tubes, because I think even we knew back in those days that it's very difficult to keep a capillary tube completely clean, and if you run it through enough capillary tubes, you're going to pick up all kinds of fun stuff.
Roughly, how do you use a capillary tube to measure boiling point of water, which is something you just mentioned? Go ahead.
Gosh, you know, I did that in 1974 or 5 and haven't done it since. So I remember doing it. I just, for the life of me, I don't remember what micro-boiling point apparatus, you know, how to explain it. But it was part of what we did, because one of the many things in qualitative and quantitative analysis that we had to go through was we were given very small samples of things and required, you can't just kind of put it in a pot with a thermometer and let it boil away. So, but unfortunately, I don't remember the little details of that.
I'm going to make a guess here. If I've only got one drop of water, and I bring a very fine capillary tube near it, and if the water then wicks itself up that tube, and then I apply a heater on the outside of the tube, and with a careful observation with something like a microscope, I can find out when the water is beginning to boil. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Eric. I mean, Roy.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a good answer. I mean, you know, it's a shame. You know, after death, I haven't really looked back on micro-boiling points in the last 40-odd years. So it's a shame that things get lost in our memory. But yeah, it could be something as simple as that. I vaguely remember putting a small capillary into a small test tube and having it draw up fluid and then heating it up in a bath and looking at the capillary tube for the gas kind of pushing up the liquid column even more, but details elude me right now. I could Google it, I'm sure. But anyway, right, this is a perfect example of well-meaning people, professionals with PhDs who get an idea in their head and they kind of jump to a conclusion and cause a lot of other people to jump to conclusions. And it went on for years until finally the Bell Lab guys finally decided to nip it in the bud. But it's sort of surprising. Science can fall down a rabbit hole, but for the most part, there's checks and double checks. So if you wait long enough, someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, no, you did it wrong, guys.
On a slightly similar note, there have been a few articles in the AAAS magazine, Science, in which they reported on not-so-well-meaning authors who came up with laboratory-measured results that had been contaminated in various ways. And so lots of claims have been made. A fair number of articles in Science magazine, I think, have been eventually been found to be erroneous. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, yeah, I mean, errors happen. People are human, and they make errors, and they misinterpret them. I mean, the most infamous recent one was the neutrinos that were calculated to be traveling faster than the speed of light. You know, and I'm surprised they let that out of the lab without quadruple checking that.
And I believe that was a honest timing error occurring in the equipment that was being used. But I think that particular belief system about the neutrinos moving a little bit faster than the speed of light going from Italy to CERN, between CERN and Italy, that persisted, it seemed like, about a month or two. And some reasonable testing of the equipment had taken place, but not super thorough testing. So eventually, a glitch in the timing system was causing it. And the error was not a great one. I think it was like 100 meters worth of error after a whole lot of miles between Switzerland and Italy. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Another case was that coal fusion. Those guys in Utah, which came up with that, and that eventually was knocked down. That was a well-reported story, the whole thing about how that came about, how eventually that went away.
And a number of other laboratories duplicated the experiment with palladium, and they thought they saw the cold fusion effect. So in the very beginning, I'm guessing there were 3, 4, or 5 laboratories that thought they saw a cold fusion. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yes, that's another wonderful example, but that went even much farther, I think, than polywater went. But the beauty, the good thing about polywater is everyone's kind of fessed up and moved on. There are guys out there still looking for that cold fusion. And, you know, of course they think there's some kind of government plot and what have you. But and some of the guys involved with the initial experiment, I don't think have fessed up to the fact that they got it wrong. I think that they think there's something wrong with the rest of us. Anyway, I mean, there's lots of examples, unfortunately, and maybe someday I'll dredge out one of those, you know, like N-rays or the Martian canals were very popular. People took them very, very seriously, and they ended up to be nothing. And there's wonderful things like phlogiston that really existed, and there is, of course, the ether in the spaces between stars and such. So there's a lot of things that don't exist that people still want to make exist somehow. Anyway. Anyone have any comments, questions, answers about the polywater or anything similar, or I'll move on to the next little puzzler for you all. Okay, very well. Now, this is going to require a little participation from the audience, so please humor me. I give you as a thought experiment a very large box. that you place a quadcopter copter drone into the box. You then seal the box airtight. You then take your remote control device out. Now you place the box with the drone on a scale, electronic scale. You've zeroed the scale, so the drone on the bottom of the box with the box sealed on the measuring device reads 0 grams or whatever. Now you turn the drone on remotely. You have it levitate 2 feet above the bottom of the box. Does the weight on the scale change? Does it go up? Does it go down? Does it stay the same? What?
This is Katie 2, LJC.
Yes, LJC.
Quick question about the drone in the box. Is it suspended, attached to the weight platform? Or is it just free-flying in the sealed box that should contain some sort of air quality so that it can hover?
It's hovering, and it's one atmosphere of room air in the box.
And is it attached to the scale, like glued to the scale, or is it's hovering because it's hovering on its own free will? I believe if it's in the air, it's pushing down. Most airplanes and stuff like that have, when they're close to the ground, have more lift from the wind because the air trapped between the wing and the ground. But I believe the helicopter would still need to pull air down. I don't know. It's definitely an interesting thought.
That's the point of the exercise, to kind of think and to just guess if you want. What you're conceiving of, would the scale read an increased force downward? Would it read less of a force than before? Or would it read the same scale? Right now, with the drone turned off on the bottom of the box, it reads 0 grams because we zeroed it. Then we've turned it on, have it levitated 2 feet above the bottom of the box. It's not attached by any wires or any ropes. It's being kept up those 2 feet by simply the operating of the quadcopter. What do you think the scale does?
Yeah, let me inject a couple of words here. By the way, Keith asked the question. I think Keith and some other people have got the misimpression that the scale is inside the box. Absolutely not. The scale is on the outside of the box. The box and its contents are sitting on the scale. The drone is inside, not attached to anything, completely free-floating. And by the way, later on we can have a tether between the drone and the bottom of the box and see if that makes any difference. But Keith, do you have the picture now or do you want to make a guess? LJC, K2RIW, go ahead, Keith.
I appreciate the clarification of the mechanism. You're pushing against the force of the air that's all circulating in the box, but yet your physical volume, everything else is the same. My guess would be that the weight on the scale would be the same because everything's in a sealed container. As I said, it's my guess. Thank you very much for the clarification. PD2LJC, back to you. Control.
You got it, Roy.
Okay, Keith, very good. Does anyone else have any other ideas of what might happen?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I also think the weight stays the same. I think this is like the box of bees. Go ahead.
AC2LR with a guess.
Okay, LR, guess away.
I agree with Keith and Professor Jones. I was just hearing on the news that shrimp that push their way to the surface of the ocean have an equal and opposite reaction on the water, thus pushing the water down. And until Keith said something, I had no idea what the answer would be, but if the rotors of the quadcopter are pushing down on the air, the weight of the box on top of the scale should remain the same, assuming it's airtight. Back to you, I guess, back to control, Dick.
Okay, very good. So you all are too smart for me. If you do that experiment, the scale will not change. While it's hovering 2 feet above, it will read the same weight as if it's sitting there passively on the ground. Now let's modify this a touch. Let's take the cover off of the thing. Does anything change? Because a lot of you guys mentioned about how it's a sealed environment. So if you now have no top on this box, does anything change?
Get lighter.
Are you saying it gets lighter because you removed the weight of the cover? Roy didn't say it, but assume you removed the cover on the box, rebalance the scale with the copter sitting on the floor of the scale of the box, then you levitate the copter 2 feet above the floor of the box. Under those conditions, what are you saying, Eric? KE2EJ, KGYIW?
Well, as we know, the way the copter flies is that weight has to press on the air. Now you don't have an unlimited, now you have an unlimited volume there. You've got the 14.7 pounds per square inch without any boundaries between it and the bottom of the box. So, that air motion that's no longer contained can freely flow in and out of the box. So my guess would be is that the scale reads slightly less.
Someone had a question?
NY1YDY, I just want to know, do we get to play with density of the air or temperatures of the air, or can we assume that those qualities are constant and that the amount of air that would go into the box would equal the amount of air that comes out of the box without the lid on?
Yeah, we're going to try and keep it as simple as humanly possible. We have one vote for it's lighter when it's levitating. Anyone want to agree or disagree or voice their opinions of what happens when you take the top of the box off?
E2LR, I agree.
Why do you want I say that it stays the same?
Very good. Now, let's take it to a more absurd extreme. And for this, I need you to imagine that the box is a really, really big box in relation to the drone, just so people don't get upset with me. Now, take the sides away from the box. So all you have is the bottom of the box. You zeroed it again. You then turn on the quadcopter. What happens to the scale reading? A VDH? VDH.
I think you're going to get fringing of the air around the edges, so I think it's going to change, probably lighter.
Okay, as I said before, for the sake of this and not getting too many complaints after the fact, this is a very, very large floor of the box. It's incredibly larger than the drone. So anyone else have any opinions of whether the weight would stay the same or get lighter or get heavier?
I'll change my tune.
You're perfectly free to change your tune, Eric. How would you like to change your tune?
Well, if you think about it, the fact that the drone or any kind of even a fixed-wing aircraft, it exerts its weight sitting on air. So that air has a downward pressure that includes the weight of the quadcopter. Now, even if the box is 3 feet tall, and you know that weight distribution is going to spread out underneath, it's still going to exert force underneath it. It's going to be, there's the fact that the air can move is kind of making my head spin a little bit, but the reality is, in order for any aircraft to be in the air, it has to exert its body weight on the air by either creating a vacuum on top of it, and the air below becomes more dense, and whether it's in the box or the box has nothing around it, that's just putting that force straight down. It's still putting that force straight down, and that force is equivalent to its weight.
Yes, indeed. You get the gold star, or most of you guys get a gold star. The best way that I have to explain what's going on is that the quadcopter is sitting on the ground because the weight of the quadcopter is acting as a force pointed towards the ground. The only way that you're going to get the quadcopter to not be on the ground is to have an opposite force with the same amount in the opposite direction, offsetting the weight. And the way you're doing that is by pushing air downward. And so the weight of the quadcopter is being repelled upward. So you don't have the weight of the quadcopter on the scale, but you do have the force of the air blowing downward that is in equilibrium with the weight of the quadcopter. So when it's sealed, it's in equilibrium. When it's open top, it's equilibrium. And even when the sides are removed, it's long enough, it's in equilibrium. If you take the base away, then a lot of the pressure of the air is outside the surface area of the measuring device, and you read a lighter weight. But otherwise, in all of those cases, in a steady state, it should weigh exactly the same, whether it's levitating or it's sitting there on the base. Now, let me ask you a question that's very close to this, but ever so slightly different. You have this enormously large surface area scale out there in the middle of nowhere, in the plains of Texas, shall we say. And a 747... that's about 2,000 feet above you, flies by. What happens to your scale that's sitting there with you?
That's going to show the increasing weight of the plane as it flies over it. It'll be ever so slight because it's dispersed, but it'll still be there.
Okay, if it was a reasonably sized scale, you would have a subsection of the surface area that the air pressure is working. If this was a fantasy thought experiment where you had a well-calibrated, well-balanced scale that had a surface area of a square mile or 5 square miles, then you would be able to measure the entire weight of a 747 as it goes past you, which I think most people, although airplane pilots would know this probably, but most people really don't think in terms of the weight of a 747 interacting with them when it's above you in the sky.
A comment?
Just comment away.
But isn't the lift normal to the surface of the wing, not depressed on the bottom? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's normal to the wing. So it's going down, and your scale is pointing up, and it should balance out.
But there's less pressure on top of the wing. I thought that's what causes the lift.
But I just stood on something.
Vic, do you want to tell the guys about Bernoulli's law?
There's a beautiful article written by some very authoritative people about Bernoulli versus Newtonian physics when it comes to the lift of a wing. Where how does really flight really take place? And the Embry-Riddle and other respected piloting schools for the last 100 years, so to speak, have been teaching essentially nothing but Bernoulli. And when you read this article, you'll find out that if you really do the calculation of Bernoulli, the longer path of air over the top of the wing has to move faster. Therefore, by Bernoulli, it runs at a lower pressure, and that's where the lift is coming from. When you actually plug in the real numbers to the Bernoulli equation, with a real wing flying at a real angle of attack at a real velocity, you come up with an amount of lift that is a very small fraction of the required lift to fly the airplane. So when you read this article, you'll suddenly find out that for nearly 100 years, no one has really done the calculation in real-world statistics, real-world quantities, and found out how much Bernoulli is doing it. That aircraft is a... Let me drop... That aircraft is a heavier-than-air craft. Air is a fluid. When a heavier-than-air craft is in that fluid called air, the only way you can develop lift is that you must be taking periodically a chunk of air and accelerating that air downward by mostly by angle of attack of the wing itself. That's where the majority of lift is coming from. The misunderstanding of that concept has created the 584 flight crash in Bar Harbor, I think it was, Queens, was because of a misunderstanding of that principle when they were flying behind a 747 Heavy and didn't realize what that how that air was being disturbed. So this is a controversial subject where an awful lot of people have heard the Bernoulli explanation, hopped on that bandwagon as if it is a religion and will not accept any other effect. The drone in the box, each of the rotary wings of that drone has Bernoulli's principle on the top and bottom of that wing. If you truly believed in nothing but Bernoulli, then the drone in the box would not measure the weight of the drone when the drone is hovering. But it really does. Let me drop. One of the most dramatic experiments along these lines was done by a program that used to be on PBS 20 years ago called Newton's Apple. On one of the Newton's Apple shows, they had a dining room table sitting on top of a scale. And they had zeroed the scale with the dining room table. They took a 4-pound radio-controlled model helicopter, set it on the top of the table. The scale read 4 pounds. They then hovered the radio-controlled helicopter 1 or 2 feet above the top of the dining room table. The scale still read 4 pounds. They flew the helicopter off to one side so it's away from the dining room table. Scale went to zero. Flew it back over the table. Scale read 4 pounds. Then they landed the helicopter on the top of the table. Except for a transient, at the instant the helicopter touched the table, it sat at 4 pounds. So if you have any reasonable area of a surface on a scale below a flying machine, you will sense completely the weight of the flying machine on that scale. A little bit opposite of common sense. And that beautiful, dramatic Newton's Apple program made it awful clear. And the Bernoulli people have a lot of trouble watching that show. AC2GS, K2IW.
Question, WS2N.
WX trying to break in, KC100X trying to break in, over.
Yeah, WS2N and then the break in after that. Paul first, great Paul.
I have a lot of planes that fly overhead, so if I had a sensitive barometer to check the pressure, you're telling me that one of these planes going directly over my house, I'm going to see a change on that barometer? Or would it have to be some kind of super sensitive type of thing? I have a barometer here. If I took that out, so I put it on a table and waited for a plane to go over, do you think it would change? Back to you, Roy.
You don't have to put the barometer outside. Leave it inside the house. There's going to be a huge delay. That puff of air being accelerated downward by the plane takes a while to reach you. When it reaches you, a very accurate barometer will measure the difference. The person trying to break in, give us your full call letters and name, and then go ahead with your information.
This is Kilo Charlie 1 India Whiskey X-Ray, broadcasting from Groton, Connecticut, trying to pick on the scientific conversation. I work at the sub-base in New London, and I have several master's degrees. Over.
Okay, India Whiskey X-Ray. Tell us what you have observed in your environment.
This is KC1IWX, broadcasting to southern, I believe, Island. I'm hoping you're picking me up loud and strong. Pushing 80 watts currently on your repeater. Over.
Joseph, we're hearing you quite well. Please give us your message.